Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome to another episode of GoTo Unscripted at the fabulous GoTo Conference. We are here in the windy city, Chicago. It's actually not that windy today, despite the flags you may see behind you. It's glorious weather over here. And I'm joined by Matt, who says we are thinking about the death of classical computer science.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. That's a nice opening provocative statement.
Yeah, let's start with talking about computing by talking about how it's all coming to an end.
Oh, I love it. Right. Great start.
Yeah, I mean, so I've been working in the AI space for, you know, the last 5 or 6 years, and I think a lot of people are seeing this, but something that really seems evident to me is that language models are becoming capable of doing kind of general purpose reasoning and computation. So not just simple things like, you know, summarize this text, although that's not that simple if you think about it, right? Or, you know, translation from one language to another, which is also incredibly complex. But also they have the ability to do problem solving. And so you can set up a problem for a language model. You can say, you know, I don't know, I have these boxes with these cards in them, and I need you to come up with an algorithm that can do the following manipulation, whatever it happens to be. And they've demonstrated that they can solve logical reasoning problems. And so if you believe that this technology is going to continue improving over time, and I see no reason why it won't, I think we're looking at a future in which, when we think about computation, we're not thinking about machine code that some human wrote. I mean, it's all machine code. It's just machine code in a different, you know, maybe it was in JavaScript or Python, but ultimately it's machine code. We're not doing machine code that people wrote. Instead, we're going to ask the language model to solve a problem, and it's just going to directly solve the problem. So I kind of think of the language model as a new computer. And to me, that's very exciting, although it's obviously very scary for a lot of people, especially, you know, folks like us who make money writing computer programs. You know, what happens when you don't have to do that anymore? So that to me is where the entire industry is going to shift. Really, just soon, in the next 5 years, I think, is we're going to see that.
So is this writing code via voice assistants, or what is the interface for creating code? Well, what's the mental model for people to think about how they're going to interact with computers? Because I'm thinking voice assistants, because people have Google Home, Alexa, that kind of thing, and that's a way they often interact with AI. And sometimes people get frustrated with that because it doesn't do what they do. So
that's right.
How do people think about expanding this world of, you know, software programming to, I suppose, anyone is what you're arguing. How does that work? What's the interface?
I think it's going to be very different than what we've been thinking about to date. And I think it'll probably go in stages. We're already seeing a world in which, you know, software developers are asking ChatGPT or Copilot to, you know, write code for them. And gosh, do I use this every day, right? I mean, you know, I take a whole block of code on my screen and I tell Copilot to, you know, refactor it, or, you know,
or just explain it to me.
Someone else's code.
That is like, that's amazing. Yeah.
What the heck is this doing? And so that kind of deep integration at the sort of source code level, I think, is, you know, obviously for programmers, for people who already understand programming. You know, we've got things like, you know, Siri and Alexa today. I've never seen anyone interact with those systems in a way that is beyond just a single step, you know, set a timer or what's the weather in Chicago today?
Play a song or whatever.
Play a song. So it'll be an interesting kind of evolution as we go down this path to see what the right interfaces are. My guess is that a beautiful intermediate point is going to be a hybrid of conventional computer use and using the AI to do things for you. So imagine you know, next year I should be able to buy a Macintosh or a Windows PC, and there should be an AI built into it that knows how to do everything on the computer, everything that I could possibly do. It knows how to use every application. It knows how to surf the web. It knows how to enter text. It knows how to, you know, navigate through screens. And so I could ask questions. I could say, hey, could you fill out a spreadsheet for me with all of the findings from this set of research reports, or, you know, whatever this task is that normally I would be sitting in front of the computer and using my mouse and my keyboard to do it. And I think that's a really powerful way of starting out. I don't think that's ultimately where it's going to end up, but just having AI use the computer like a human would. And we've already seen a few instances of this. Microsoft has some Copilot features that they're building into all of their products. Apple seems to be a little behind on that, which is interesting, but you never know what Apple's going to come out with next.
Yeah, and Apple Intelligence with, you know, new hardware and software completely integrated. Yeah,
right.
We still have to see what that is actually going to look like.
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful branding moment for them, and they kind of have to stay on top of that. I used to be on that team at Apple, so I know a fair bit about how they think about the problem. But, you know, the next kind of computer that we're going to have is not one that you open it up and the mouse and the keyboard are the primary ways you interact with it. It'll be talking to it probably. And I think voice actually will end up being incredibly powerful, although there's still places I'm going to want to type, you know, like when I'm on an airplane or something. Yeah. Nobody wants to have the person next to them talking to their computer.
People will be talking on trains again, just talking to their AIs.
Exactly.
So if people are looking at large language models at the moment and they sort of realizing what they can do, there's often great power with that, but there's also a lot of frustration when the large language model doesn't do what you want it to do.
Yeah.
Large language models at the moment are sort of fixed at a point in time when they were trained for gazillion dollars.
Right.
And so people get sometimes frustrated with the lack of the recency of information.
Right.
How are language models going to evolve? Because one of the concerns I have as well is that these are costing, you know, many billions to train.
Right.
But the revenue from large language models, you know, is, you know, probably an order of, you know, 10 or 20x of actually being able to get money to support this. So
right,
we're seeing a great future and positing a great future for long language models. But what is the future of, you know, creating these expensive models and getting them in the hands of people and them being relevant and useful? There's probably a lot of different, too many questions in one sentence there.
But I think there's really two pieces there. I mean, we're kind of forced today, if you're serious about building language models, you're forced today to more or less drop millions of dollars to train a new model. That's starting to change. You know, people could take open source models as a baseline and then fine tune those. And so I tend to think that the general base level of intelligence will ultimately be commoditized, and it will ultimately be something that you just effectively anybody gets off the shelf. And, you know, the Llama models from Meta are a great example of a starting point there. But I think, you know, more relevant to your question is, how do we integrate AI and language models into the ways that we do other things in the world? And, you know, right now, the primary way people are interacting with things like ChatGPT is just through a text box in a web page. And it's kind of siloed off from everything, right?
Chat button,
It can't, but it doesn't even know how to contact other websites or perform actions on your behalf.
It doesn't remember your last request in another browser window,
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's very much a little silo, but there's been lots of demonstrations and people building out things that give the language model appendages where it can connect to your data or access APIs or surf the web or have a history, right? And that hasn't really become a product yet. And I think once that becomes a product, once you actually have an AI agent that has the ability to interact with other things in the world the way that you would as a human and has memory, once that is an existing product, then I think people will really start to see the opportunity there. But while it's still kind of a IKEA furniture, you know, you kind of have to bolt it together and, you know, figure out how to use the function calling API and figure out how to deal with all the security things. And all those things are your problem now as somebody trying to use this tech. I think it's still going to stay very much in the, you know, kind of hobbyist workshop.
Is that a sort of peek into the future, talking about function calling or agentic workflows or a bit of RAG to, you know, augment the model with your data? Are they the sort of first baby toddler steps yes. of what we can head to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see all of that as just pointing towards ultimately what do you need to use these language models effectively, and how do you integrate it into a complete, you know, user modality? In other words, how does it go from, you know, oh, go run all these obscure Docker commands on your laptop and write a Jupyter notebook, which is what people have to do today, to, you know, I opened up my laptop and it's able to do this for me, right? And I don't think we're very far from this. I was just looking 20 minutes ago at the latest stuff about how people are bringing together language models and kind of conventional computing. And, you know, I've seen demos of this going back a couple of years now. And for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, all of these things never seem to get past the cool video demo phase. They never seem to turn into a product. And I don't think that's for lack of demand. And I don't think that there's really a technical limitation there either. I think it's that maybe a business opportunity comes along, or maybe it ends up getting really specialized in a particular domain or something like that. But, you know, I do think it'll, you know, before the iPod, there were dozens of MP3 players on the market, you know, and they were all kind of clunky and hard to use and didn't really interface well with the rest of your music library. And there wasn't a good way of bringing music in. And Apple said, no, we're going to solve this problem. And they solved the whole problem, and just by bringing it all together. So, you know, maybe it'll be Apple that ends up having to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting, of thinking some, you know, companies are behind, but actually just the innovation behind the scenes is, you know, far more relevant to what's going to build the future.
Right.
When you were talking about AI models and, you know, the Llama models and being open source and this kind of thing, how do you see the future of data and what's going to be used to train these models, and even the open source of these models? Because there are different levels of open source, and the actual training data is now literally the information on the internet. So I want to park the sort of privacy and whether you want your data to be done, you know, for a separate question. But
right.
What is open source in terms of an LLM, and how open should that be? Is it the models? Is it the weights? How should people be thinking about in the future when you say there is a base level of intelligence built on something like open source, which we'll build on? People want to understand what's in the model.
I think it's exactly true. I mean, my view is it's so expensive. It takes a lot of expertise to build these models today. And so it's not surprising that companies like OpenAI would, you know, largely want to keep their models proprietary. It makes a lot of sense business-wise. I do think that it's going to become commoditized. It's going to become more open, really, because people are going to demand that. It will not work to have a single company hold a monopoly on all of that. And in large part because of all of the places that people want to use this tech, right? Going through an API endpoint and sending your sensitive data off to OpenAI or Microsoft or whomever has that monopoly just isn't going to work for a tremendous number of use cases. And so the fact that there's really not a technical barrier to having language models that are just as good as what OpenAI has, but are also open and can be deployed anywhere and don't require sending your data off to an entity that you don't necessarily trust. We know that this is completely possible. You know, I mean, I run the Llama models on my laptop. Mm. You know, over time, the computers are going to get more powerful. The models will become more powerful. We'll learn better ways of training and tuning these things so they use less resource.
It's also the training is, you know, ridiculously compute intensive, but the inference
yes, exactly.
isn't as much. So the inference we can do at the moment, but
exactly.
some way there's, well, I don't know if it's necessarily going to merge, but you want to be retraining the model as often as you can, kind of thing.
I think that's true, although my gut tells me there's going to be a place where we get where this starts to become a self-perpetuating yeah. process. And, yeah. you know, people talk about Gen AI or general purpose or AGI, you know, what does AGI mean? You know, really the next generation of models will end up being trained by the current generation of models, and then it will just start itself down a path of improving all the time without too much human interaction. Today, we're forced to do that through more data, through more training data, you know, scraping more of the web or, you know, whatever it happens to be. But I tend to think of that as a bootstrapping process that ultimately will hit a ceiling, And the reason I think this is...
You run out of the world's data.
Well, we will run out of data at some point, but I don't think that means the models are not going to get smarter. And I think part of that is because we are going to start to understand better what structures and what kinds of things are happening inside of the model that need to be boosted and which things need to be suppressed and which things need to be tuned and which things need to be excised.
Which is going to reduce the cost of training
and
the models
it will reduce
as well,
the cost.
And
like
the time,
now we're getting lucky by just throwing everything at a giant pile of neurons and just saying, well, we have no idea how it works. But once we understand better how it works, I tend to think we can make it more intelligent in other ways than just having more data.
And I think the openness also plays into academia. I mean, you were, you know, professor of computer science at Harvard. I think, you know, universities at the moment are locked out of a lot of this Gen AI stuff because they don't have gazillions of money to train a model. And so they're reliant on, you know, these other companies, which are doing a great job. I mean, I don't want to denigrate the work that they're doing.
Right.
But you can't lock academia out purely on a cost and resourcing model to do this. And, you know, and maybe it's a cross-governmental thing of a CERN kind of thing to do it currently. But yeah, you know, these models need to be, you know, widely disseminated and open so researchers and university and academic institutions can go crazy with them and build the new stuff.
Right. I mean, I've definitely seen plenty of universities do interesting research where they'll start with something like Llama as a baseline, and so they didn't have to spend millions of dollars training that from scratch, but then doing interesting innovations that sit on top of that. So one that I've seen recently is a model that was trained on something like 173 languages that none of these other models really know how to speak at all, right? And so they started with Llama as a baseline and then brought in more training data and more examples, and they were more careful about how they went through the training process. So this model outperforms anything that's out there in terms of its multilingual capabilities. And that was all done in a university setting with, you know, presumably a limited budget because fine tuning is relatively affordable. It's still expensive. It does worry me a great deal that so much of the innovation happening in computing today is reliant on having lots and lots and lots of data and resources that an academic cannot expect to have. For the last 50 years of computing...
Probably countries can't expect to have
it. The whole countries can't expect to have it. And for the first 50 years of computing, I mean, it was within reach for a reasonably well-funded university research group to be at the cutting edge of pretty much anything in computing, because scale was not that important. I mean, even if I was designing a new chip, I only needed one of those to, you know, write the paper, right? So the fact that now you need, you know, entire warehouses full of machines in order to do some of this fundamental work does mean that it's going to be increasingly difficult for academics to stay on top of it. In the past, the government has, and other various governments around the world, but speaking for the US, you know, DARPA has put a lot of resource into bolstering the infrastructure and the tools that are available to academics so that they can do this cutting edge work. I don't know that they're doing as much of that today, which is too bad. But I know my entire PhD was funded by, you know, the DARPA when they said, sure, we're going to give a few million dollars to, you know, University of California so that they can build out all of these machines and networks to do this research.
Well, we're talking about the models, and at the moment, the big drive is to have bigger and bigger models because you want the model to do everything, and you want to ask your ChatGPT or your, you know, Amazon Q or your whatever pick a model to do a coding challenge, and the next question is about a recipe, and the next question is explain the rules of baseball to me, or this kind of thing.
Right?
Is that the future going forward, or does it actually make more sense to have sort of smaller, more targeted models with something that figures out which is the best model for the job?
Well, I mean,
technically, or is that a ridiculous question?
I mean, no, it's exactly the right question. And you know, what's kind of ironic is that these models like GPT-4o, they are in fact an ensemble of little specialized models inside. It's just that the way that they're trained, that's an automated process in terms of how those specializations are done. So it wasn't somebody came along and said, well, we think recipes are important. Let's go and, you know, make a recipe model here. It just sort of happened naturally as part of the training process.
I suppose that at least that black box of you don't quite know what's happening inside a model.
Yes.
I suppose I intuitively knew that there must be different, you know, neural pathways and things to do different things in a model. But when you then say, well, there is actually lots of different models orchestrated in one, it's like,
interesting. That is effectively how they work internally, but it's just sort of the magic. And it's still more of a black box in terms of how that is working and how they're being coordinated and how they interact. It's a good question. Generally, I think, smart people would say, of course, we're just going to end up with a bunch of specialized models and we'll have an orchestration layer on top. Architecturally, that makes a lot of sense. But I think that might be representative of, how we would conventionally think about taking a computer system and decomposing it into pieces to components that have APIs between them and interact. And then
the CPU, the storage bus, the network card, which
is at the hardware level or at the software level. Yeah. But the way that we are going about it with AI is so different. I tend to think we probably won't end up there. I think we'll probably...
How are we going about it differently?
Well, because what we're doing is we're just saying, like, let's take, 70 billion neurons or whatever the number is just throwing all the data at it and we get a result at the end. In some sense, we're not decomposing it and we're not applying a kind of human-centric way of organizing it. It's self-organizing. And I tend to think that when something like this works, even if we don't understand it that well, that ends up being the thing that gains traction. The downside, there's many downsides, but one of the biggest downsides, of course, is that the next model that comes out is going to require, too many GPUs for any one human to own. And so you end up in a situation where it just sort of becomes out of reach. It would be wonderful to have a thing where I can take one of those massive models and say, let me just distill it down for my use case, teaching French or programming Python and get something that's small and compact and just as effective within that domain, but also good at saying, this is out of domain for me. If you ask it about Shakespeare,
not elucidating Spanish in a French accent. In this sort of future of democratizing access to computing power, which is what you're also saying, that in fact everybody in the world can be a programmer. Obviously, we started off by saying that's going to freak out some current programmers who are worried about their jobs, but there seem to be an unlimited need of people to program things and to create value in the world. So I know you're doing a talk later. Tell us about that, of this ideas of yours of everybody's going to be a programmer.
Well, when I was growing up in the 80s and, the early home computers like the Apple II, Apple II Plus, when you bought one of these computers, it was expected you were going to program it. Mm. It was never expected that you were just going to buy it and then just play a game or use a spreadsheet.
That's actually very true.
Thing and the damn manual said, here's how to use BASIC. Yeah. It was part of the, every one of these things was sold as a thing that could be programmed. And I think obviously part of that was reflecting the fact that at the time they couldn't do a whole lot and it was expected that people needed to really customize what it was going to do. And there wasn't as many commercial applications that were already built up that you could just go buy and, start using.
So typing in games from a magazine. I remember doing that.
I did tons of
trying to find the mistake you made on page, whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I typed a minus sign instead of a plus sign. And that's
old manual at computing magazines.
The moon lander is crashing or whatever. And so it was just sort of assumed everybody was going to be a programmer. And I think, obviously in the last, 2 to 3 decades, we've moved very far from that. And, now what computing means to most people in the world is a phone with Facebook and WhatsApp on it. And they don't even know that much about the internet or Google or the web. They're just using these siloed, limited experiences. And my thinking is part of what's happening is we have a widening gap between this kind of elite priesthood of programmers like myself, I include myself in this category, that have been trained and learn how to build software and understand how to do all these arcane things, and I can produce applications that other people can use, but most people can never program. Most people are never going to be able to. Well, the question is, if we get to a place where the language models are really good at solving problems, interacting with other systems, interacting with the real world, and you can instruct them in natural language, I think we've substantially eliminated the barrier to just a regular person, a non-expert, effectively being able to ask their computer or their phone or whatever the device is to do anything for them. And if that comes about, I think that's actually a very good thing in the long run, because it says we're able to put the power of computing in everyone's hands. It's not just up to a few big rich companies to, monopolize, what you're able to do. Google monopolizes what people do on their Android phones. Facebook monopolizes what people do in all these Facebook-owned apps. And so they've made these decisions about what you can and can't do on your computing device. This is going to open it up. Now, do people want to program? I don't think they want to program, but they do have jobs to get done all the time.
I think they want to create programs, but not program. Kind of thing. They want to create right. something, yeah.
They want to use the computer yeah. as a way of solving problems for them. So years ago, when I was on the faculty at Harvard, we had a sales rep from Apple come and give a presentation to the engineering department saying, here's all the wonderful things about the latest version of Macs and why you should use it in your research and teaching. And at the time, Macs were not quite as prevalent as they are now. And so, you know, it was actually sort of relevant. It's like, oh, here's what Apple's got. You know, most of us don't use Apple machines. And at one point, he was demonstrating the Automator program on the Mac, which lets you give these little simple programs to automate a common task, cut and paste from one document to another, or send an email with the contents of this spreadsheet or whatever. Just a very simple little programming environment that the Macs have had for a long time. And he said the funniest thing. He said, it's like having a robot in your computer. And I said, you mean it's like having a computer?
Yeah.
Because I thought his point was telling is that we've lost this idea that tailoring it or customizing it for our needs is something sort of fundamental to how computers operate. Mm. They're not just like buying a blender or a camera, yeah. right? It's a general purpose computing device, but we've put all these barriers in the way. So if we eliminate those barriers, I would very much expect people to start to do very interesting things with computing that they're not currently able to do. And I think AI is the path to getting us there.
And probably things we can't even think of what they could create, because we don't know what the possibilities are. I mean, the human ingenuity and spark is ultimate creativity. So yeah, what they're going to create is going to be an
That's
explosion.
Right. I mean, my wife is a psychiatrist, and she has all of these fairly interesting bespoke computing tasks that she needs done, largely having to do with manipulating data, pulling things out of records or documents, organizing things, visualizing things. And I think a lot of people have this need, but you know, she's not going to be well equipped to sit down and learn, you know, Python or something to do all of that. And so, you know, if some application doesn't exist already that has the features she needs, she just ends up doing it by hand. And we see this over and over again, people cutting and pasting between spreadsheets or whatever it happens to be the process. So I think that there's just so much opportunity here to unleash the general purpose nature of computing, but you have to give people the right interface. And I think AI is the way to get there.
So how does this not become the new elitism of we say this sounds very altruistic and great, you know, democratize computing to everyone who can use it. But unfortunately, the history of computing trajectory at the moment is more money, more, you know, the richer it get more, you know, closed access to things.
Right.
So how does one break that trajectory?
I think it's interesting. You know, I was an early adopter of Linux back in the early 90s. And wrote one of the first books about Linux. So we were having the same conversation about Linux back then, which was, you know, Microsoft was and Sun Microsystems and IBM, okay. These were the behemoths. Yeah. And, you know, Linux was the underdog that was going to open this up to all these people and make it really accessible. And I actually think, if I think back to those days and what I anticipated was going to happen, what's the most successful Linux could ever be? I never anticipated the degree of success it has in fact had. If you think about every Android phone on the planet is running Linux. Like, none of us anticipated something like that. So I tend to think that the when you start to open these things up, they tend to go into lots of directions that you don't expect. Sure, there's going to be people that are going to try to put the genie back in the bottle and figure out how they can make money out of it. And they're going to say, well, you know, I've got a better solution. So let me, you know, control your access to this so that you can't do anything, you know, everything you want with your computer. We've seen this with Apple. You know, you can't just develop an iPhone app or a Mac app and distribute it. You can't. Right. Unless it goes through their review process, that you can't give it to anybody. And that really bothers me, because fundamentally it's just software. There's nothing that should stop us from doing
bits
that.
And bytes, yeah.
So I do think that ultimately, you know, the universe bends towards, you know, more open.
And so openness, well, when we were talking earlier about, you know, the open sourcing of the models all the way down to the weights and allowing academic researchers access to that, that sort of is the key unlocker for making this universal.
Yes, I think that's one of the key unlockers, but I think it will be impossible ultimately to contain it once it's out there and people can just start using it however they want.
Just sort of switching tack slightly, you've been working in the AI field for many years, sort of before the current, you know, explosion of Gen AI, and that has been a few years in the making from, you know, Google's papers on transformers and everything, which and that's sort of core research which has then come out into Gen AI. What is the research that you're looking at the moment, which, you know, points into a future of sort of new and exciting things that are coming out? Because I know research doesn't happen today and tomorrow their products built from it. So yeah, I think the Google Transformer paper was 2017, if I seem to remember, or something like that. That's already, you know, 7 years ages ago, years ago. Right. So that is ages ago in Gen AI parlance. You know, what's the sort of next from the research that you're seeing?
I'm seeing so many things, but one that I'm particularly excited about is real-time voice. And anyone who's tried to use the advanced voice mode in ChatGPT, it's unbelievable. You can ask it to speak like it's out of breath. You can tell it to use a Dutch accent. You can have it speak backwards. It works in so many interesting ways. And the key innovation there is something that the company that I used to be involved with, Fixie.ai, has been innovating in, is how do you design and train a model that does not go through text. In other words, you can go directly from voice input to voice output.
Because everything is text at the moment, all the training and
all of it is you're training that core on text, but then the models are translating things into text and then feeding text in, doing the reasoning, and then turning that text back into audio output. Well, there's two problems. The first problem is it's slower, and when you're having a conversation like we're having now, you really need the latency to be as low as possible. So you need to eliminate that extra step.
Are you an AI now? Well, are we having a conversation?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you wouldn't know. And the other is you lose a lot of information when you've gone through a text layer first, because your enunciation, your tone, the stress you put on certain syllables, the timing of how you speak, your emotion, all of these things come through in audio that you lose in a text representation. And so what's kind of exciting is if you imagine a world in which you just go from voice to voice or voice to some other, you know, medium, could be video to video, could be something else, I think it really unlocks a lot of interesting use cases. I was surprised to see how fast that world started to move. When we were working on this in the early days at Fixie, and by early days, I mean, you know, like 6 months ago, like not that long ago, we thought, gosh, you know, we're way ahead of the curve. No one else is going to be able to do this. We're already seeing, you know, ChatGPT launch a very similar feature. We've seen a few other companies do it. And so I think the pace of innovation in this whole field is just accelerating all the time. And it's quite remarkable how that's happening. It's very hard to keep up with what the latest research is.
When we're talking about sort of opening, democratizing access to the world to sort of become programmers, I mean, there are a lot of naysayers with Gen AI and even AGI, you know, taking all of our jobs, getting rid of everything that we're doing. And, you know, we've been obviously very, you know, positive and excited about the possibilities that AI is going to create in the future. But there are a lot of people concerned about the negative consequences, and that's, you know, technically and socially and economically and resource, you know, everything. What are your thoughts on those, some of those?
I worry a great deal about many of these things. I mean, myself, I lean heavily on ChatGPT to do thinking for me. You know, for the talk I'm going to be giving in an hour and a half here, I definitely had ChatGPT's help in brainstorming some ideas, exploring some themes, asking for research on different parts of the space that I'm talking about. I wouldn't have had that even a year ago. And so the question is, does that make me intellectually lazy? And if you become intellectually lazy, does that mean you just sort of stop putting in the effort to really think hard about things because you kind of realize, well, fine, any old time I want to, you know, do some noodling on this idea, I've got my, you know, ever excited and quite verbose assistant over here that will help me out.
He doesn't moan and complain.
Yes, exactly. I do think equity is going to be tremendously important, especially if we're going to try to open this up so that anybody can leverage it to tailor and customize computing to their needs. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the language models, actually, they don't do a great job in languages that are not French, English, you know, actually Vietnamese is one of the best languages for Llama models. Just a lot of great training data on Vietnamese out there, but relatively little training data on, say, Igbo or Amharic. But there's so many more people that speak all of these languages that don't have the access just to say, I'm going to learn English. And so I think that
and shouldn't
there's
have to.
Well, they certainly shouldn't have to. But, you know, different populations are, you know, depending on the population, are more or less able to kind of squeak by with English. In this case, you know, certainly not. So that's a concern. I think the other thing is just the cost. These models are so expensive to use. And, you know, I pay $20 a month to OpenAI for ChatGPT Pro or whatever they call it. That is far, far out of reach for most of the population of the planet. It's far too expensive for them. In fact, in order to use ChatGPT in that way, I have to have a $3,000 laptop that I access it with, and I have to have a $80 a month internet connection that I can use it through. And so all of these costs really add up. So I do think that the costs and accessibility will come down naturally over time, as technology does. But we need to make sure we're also focused on closing some of those gaps, especially with things like language coverage. And just cultural knowledge. I mean, if I were someone living in South India and trying to use these models to, you know, plan a wedding or something like that, I don't know that it would give me the right pieces of information. It would probably tell me a lot of things about how to plan a wedding in Europe or North America, but
probably
not offend so much.
You with some of the things it's going to suggest.
Exactly, right.
But in fact, you know, that also does bring up a whole point. I'm sort of, you know, diving a bit into the sort of negative aspects of it, talking about voice to voice, you know, deep fakes and impersonation. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what is truth in a AI generated world?
Yeah, I don't know where this is going to go. From time to time, I've thought, you know, we perhaps need some way of certifying that a piece of an utterance or a piece of text or something came from a bona fide human, or we need to ensure that all the models are watermarking the information that they're generating so that we can detect what came from AI and what came from a human. By the same token, I kind of wish that any car that was in self-driving mode had a big blue light on the front of it or something so that I knew that it was self-driving at that time, because I'm going to, as a pedestrian, for example, or another driver, I might actually want to interact differently with that car if I knew that there was computer control instead of human control on it. But I think we're going to have to figure that out as a society. I don't know what the answer is. You know, laws and regulations around these things are often well-intentioned, but just really can screw it up if you
Well, the recent California bill, which was knocked down, and that was so interesting because you could see the sort of points on both sides. And I think everybody recognizes that, of course, we want some regulation on AI that is not going to go crazy.
Right.
But is it too early to regulate? And, you know, what are you regulating? I mean, regulating the model based on, you know, an amount of maths it can do seems crazy. So, struggling with the legislation.
Exactly. So it's well-meaning. And you know, I don't think that there's any malice there. But it is one of those where we don't know how to regulate a technology that is itself evolving so rapidly. And we're going to have to face this as a society. I have two kids in school. They're going to growing up in a world now with AI is all omnipresent for them. And it's a different world than what I grew up in.
How are they going to learn critical thinking?
Critical thinking. How are they actually going to learn how to write an essay or... Yeah. You know, think through some complex set of problem if they can always just pull ChatGPT out of their pocket.
In terms of people who say that, you know, artificial general intelligence is just around the corner and the robots are going to take over and decimate humans on Earth, when you were talking about the robot in a computer earlier, you know, the robot on the planet, and if all humans can create any computer program, well, computer programs can also create computer programs.
Right.
Is this a never-ending cycle into the vortex of explosion or something?
I do think that it is, but not in the way that most people think it is. In other words, I tend to think that the way in which AI destroys society is not because the AI has maliciously arisen to, you know, have some self-interested behavior that causes it to, you know, start to put people in fuel tanks or whatever it ends up doing. I don't think it's that. I think it is that we as a society fail to respond to how it's affecting our society, and we fail to think about how to incorporate it in the right ways. And we allow companies and governments that have all the resources and all of the, you know, incentive to really capitalize on it to just run with it in whatever way they think is best. And so, you know, if you think about it, something like Facebook has probably done more damage to society, if you just objectively look at it, than almost any other piece of technology in the last 20 years. But it certainly didn't arise due to malice. Yeah. It was simply because of the way in which it was adopted in society. And
my family
in which
connect with each other in the most incredible way across the globe.
And it's an amazing product.
But I also have young kids trying to avoid social media, and it's socially toxic. Yeah,
exactly. So I think the problem is us, not the tech. I think externalizing it and saying the tech is going to take off and, you know, destroy society, I think it's not that. I think society will destroy itself if we're not careful about how we use the tech.
I mean, will the machines get clever enough to even do that, or is the machine still always going to be controlled by humans?
I think it will be clever enough to do that. I do think that the idea of there being a machine that is more intelligent than humans is not far off. In fact, some people would say in certain narrow domains, we've already achieved that. I mean, with playing chess, for example. Mm. So we have to accept that as a reality and not just believe it can never happen. I think, again, the question is, how do we incorporate this tech? I mean, we are right now the people who are deciding how the tech is used in society and what kind of access to people and places and things it has. But, you know, maybe we should be worried. We're putting AI tech into every one of these cars that's going to eventually be able to just drive itself. And that has all kinds of implications for, you know, public safety and other kinds of things. So we're wrestling with that in lots and lots and lots of domains, not just in the language space.
Is artificial intelligence even intelligence? Because there seems to be this moving line of the next algorithm ahead that does something that is a bit more interesting and exciting than the one we understand today is artificial intelligence. That, you know, that line keeps moving.
Yeah, this is such a debate, and I think because we don't know how these models are working, you know, the debates rage on and on and on.
Because it's magic, it's artificial intelligence.
Right. Someone like Jeff Hinton would probably say it is intelligent. Someone like Jan LeCun says it's not. It's very hard to know because we don't know what intelligence is. We don't know what natural intelligence is. We certainly don't know what artificial intelligence is. All we can do is reason through what do we observe and what can we do with it? And, you know, the fact that I can go and ask ChatGPT to write me an essay or to make talk slides or generate these images that are incredibly photorealistic, sure, yeah, that's intelligence as far as I'm concerned, because I have no way of discerning that from a human having done the same thing in most cases. Again, it's kind of coming back to the idea of the Turing test. So I don't know, and I think it's sort of an academic argument. People would say, well, no, but true intelligence has the following properties. And whatever test you put in front of the technology, I guarantee it will ultimately be able to surpass that test. So I think the debate is academic. We don't know what intelligence is anyway, so let's stop arguing about it.
Is there anything top of mind that we haven't covered today that you'd like to mention?
I think there's a lot of scary stuff that's likely to happen or could happen, but I do think that this is a huge opportunity for us. And the thing that I really try to get people to think about is, how can we embrace this future instead of fighting it? I think a lot of programmers in particular push back on the idea that AI is going to take their jobs. And I think the bottom line is it will. I think we have to accept that the number of people employed in the programming field in 10 or 20 years
doing
is
what
going
we
to be
do today.
Significantly fewer than we have today. That's my belief. And they're going to make a lot less money. And we've seen this happen many, many times in many industries over history. So the idea that technology can disrupt a career path or a vocation should not be at all a surprise to any of us. But the question is, what do we get in return, right? And I think for that, we have to look to what do we want out of the technology? Why are we developing this in the first place? It's not to enrich Elon Musk and Sam Altman, I hope, right? I hope that there's some bigger purpose here than just making a few people really rich. And so that's where we have an opportunity now to say, okay, should we focus our energies on, say, increasing equity and access to this to lots of people around the world? This is a choice that we all have to make. And I think for people to think about it through that lens, I think is helpful because it opens up opportunities rather than closing them.
And I think there's a societal question of, you know, what do people do in the future? I'm also in the belief that AI is going to come up with a whole new things, and we still haven't figured out what humans are going to come up with that's going to run on top of that AI. So I'm certainly not pessimistic about that, but it needs to be talked about openly in a, you know, governmental and global scale of
right.
the impact on humans and our lives living in this world.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a nice
fascinating
conversation
all about AI. Thanks for joining us on Go To Unscripted in lovely Chicago. What a pleasure to be able to talk to the brightest minds in the industry and find out what they're thinking about all the cool things in our lovely industry. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.